Hi, my name is Kevin Day. I'm the Executive Resident with the National Community Pharmacists Association. I'm here today for the Pharmacist Continuing Education Webinar, Community Pharmacy and Transitions of Care. I'm joined on the line by Josh Akers, a pharmacist with the Kelly Ross Pharmacy Group in Seattle, Washington. Josh is a Kelly Ross manager and the Residency Director for the Clinical Pharmacy Institute. Kelly Ross is a community pharmacy that has been working with the Virginia Mason Heart Institute in Seattle, Washington, to run a transitions of care program for the last several months. So let's jump right into it. What are transitions of care? In the biggest picture, transitions of care is any time a patient moves from one level of care to another. Commonly these days, as everyone's talking about transitions of care and it's such a hot topic, we're talking about the transition from hospital to home. And a patient that moves from the everyday constant monitoring of a hospital setting to living life and taking care of their own health back in their home setting. However, there's also transitions of care that happen between hospital and a long-term care facility, maybe a skilled nursing facility or assisted living. One of those facilities, again, skilled nursing, assisted living, and others, to the home setting, and also vice versa, from home to skilled facility or home to hospital. Really, even potentially a transition such as from a primary care physician to a specialist could be considered transitions of care. But for this webinar and in general, when NCPA is talking about transitions of care throughout this month, we're going to be talking about the transition between hospital and home. Because again, that's the one that most of our colleagues in the healthcare fields are talking about and is the hot topic around. So why is it such a big deal? Why are so many people talking about this issue? It's really simple. 20% of Medicare beneficiaries, give or take, are readmitted to a hospital within 30 days of discharge. This is an overall average, regardless of diagnosis, and any variety of complexing factors. Total overall, it's 1 in 5 Medicare beneficiaries who's admitted to the hospital and gets discharged ends up back in the hospital or another facility within 30 days. And this number has been really stagnant for a long time. Even with the focus the last couple of years on trying to really improve transitions and reduce these readmission numbers, the 20% number is essentially stable. It might be down a percentage point or two over the last handful of years. These readmissions are both really hard on the patients and the families and even the caregivers, right? When I have been in the hospital before and you work really hard to get a patient good enough to go home, and then they show up again a week later, it can be incredibly disheartening, even to the hospital staff. But also, there's a huge financial strain from these readmissions and the extra care that they cost the system. In fact, it's estimated to cost Americans about $25 billion just in the Medicare space every year for these readmissions. So is anyone doing anything about this? Obviously, it's a big issue. I think we can all agree to that. And that answer, again, is yes. It's why it's being talked about so much is because people are working. There's a lot of different players involved who are trying to improve these processes across the country and make the readmission process smoother and reduce the readmissions. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, launched a program, a hospital readmission reduction program in 2012 to target these readmissions and to target the transitions of care processes, again, specifically from hospital to home. And this program penalizes hospitals based on their readmission rates for certain disease states. So there's 5 disease states right now, 6 that gets added next year that the readmission rates are based off of and calculated from. Those include heart failure, pneumonia, acute MI, but also maybe something you wouldn't expect in the total hip or total knee replacements. Initially, in 2012, the maximum penalty through this program was 1%. Currently, though, hospitals can face penalties as high as 3%. Certainly, there aren't a ton of hospitals across the country that are facing a 3% penalty, but there are many that are facing significant penalty. The average across the country is a 0.63% penalty. And as a percentage, that might sound really small, but we have to remember how this penalty works, that this is off of their entire Medicare reimbursement. So whatever they are expecting to get paid from Medicare through the course of a year, that's where their penalty is being deducted from. So if you would bill for a $10,000 hospital stay to Medicare and you're facing a 3% penalty, you're getting paid 3% less than what you had probably had budgeted for and what the hospital was expecting to be getting. Not all hospitals are affected, but nearly 2,600 hospitals are currently facing some penalty. And CMS estimates that that is going to total out to about $400 million this year in reimbursement that Medicare is not going to pay to the hospitals. That averages to about $200,000 per hospital for this current fiscal year. How does the penalty work? The math on this page is not as simple as I may have made it seem with the slide that's available on slide 8. But I put the equations in here because I wanted to show that there is, you know, a mathematical process to this. And although as a pharmacy maybe considering approaching a hospital to launch a citizens of care program, having perfect understanding of this may or may not be important for you. But I think it is important to understand that the hospital knows this data. They know how this equation works. They've done their own math. And yes, their math doesn't matter compared to the math that CMS does. If there's a discrepancy, CMS is going to win out there on that conversation. But you know that the hospitals are doing their math on a regular basis to try to update and guesstimate what their penalty might be. So this is split two ways between formulas to calculate the readmission adjustment factor and then how that factor is used to compute the readmission payment adjustment amount. And again, if you look through the formula on the top left side, you can see that it's split out by disease state. Acute MI, it's AMI, HF for heart failure, PN for pneumonia, COPD, and the total hip, total knee replacement that I mentioned a moment ago. Also, you can tell that these are sums of all of these added back together to make the factor. So one hospital might have a readmission penalty assessed to them because they are, you know, behind the average. I won't say they're necessarily bad, but behind the average on a single disease state. It might be something that they really struggle for some reason or another with heart failure patients that are discharged from the hospital and end up being readmitted at a higher rate than what across the country would be considered the norm. They might be great on the other four, but if heart failure is bad enough, they could still be facing a significant penalty. Another hospital, possibly across the city, might be facing the same penalty, and that might be due to, you know, a little bit above average on readmission rates across all five of the different disease states that are being evaluated. So there are many different ways that hospitals are going to be penalized about this, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk through that a little bit is to make sure that if you're going to approach a hospital again, you have to understand that they are going to know these numbers like the back of their hand, or at least very likely for that to be the case. So it's important for you to go in as educated as you can be. And Josh is going to talk a little bit later about some of the resources that are available publicly that you can use to help educate yourself on what the local hospital is that you might be considering working with. There's more details about this and the program in general on CMS's site, cms.gov, and you know, if you just Google CMS HRRP, that'll come up right away on Google. So clearly this is a problem, and the hospital financial issue is something that, you know, is motivating many people to look and consider different things. So is there a role for you as a community pharmacist? And that answer absolutely is yes. I think of these are patients that are going from the hospital to the home, and the most accessible healthcare provider from a home setting is the community pharmacist. So there are ways for you to improve care for your patients and your community to reduce long-term penalties for the hospital, which there's a financial incentive here for hospitals to possibly be involved in a program with you, and also to increase business for your pharmacy, right? If you can recruit some of the patients that you're going to help through to become your patients and utilize that service, there's a chance there for revenue as well. So with that kind of high-level introduction, I'm going to hand this over to Josh and let him talk specifically about his program and that Kelly Ross is involved in. So with that, Josh, I'll let you take it away.
And really, this is important because this is really what patient-centered care is all about. So it can't be just about what we do with the patient when they're there. We can say we're providing patient-centered care, but if we are really doing patient-centered care, it's about that patient moving across the continuum and making sure they are getting the care they need wherever they may be, whether it's going from the hospital to the SNF to the back to the community, wherever it may be. Now, this can be extremely challenging because as we think about this and trying to work across organizations, probably the biggest problem we're going to encounter is communication. Many of you have even had communication issues even within your own organization. But now if we want to start trying to do this across systems, across different organizations with different policies, different procedures, It's definitely a very, very large challenge for us in healthcare, but this really is what patients should expect, and this is a challenge worth facing, and one of the things that we continue to work on to have effective transitions of care for patients. Now, I don't know if many of you have done home visits before, but this picture that you're seeing now, this is actually something very, very common with many in-home visits that we do with patients. We look at this, and some of you may remember those old highlights magazines. Go ahead and circle everything that's wrong with this picture. There's a few things that are potentially wrong here. This is not even a staged picture. This is straight out of a patient's home visit that I performed. So there are a lot of different issues, and this is something that many patients experience. They don't know what they're doing when they get home. They may have adherence solutions. They have different bottles, different pharmacies. They have strange storage conditions. There's a lot of things going on, and oftentimes they are extremely overwhelmed. So this is something that I like to kind of frame to keep in mind as we kind of go through the transitions, that this may be what our patients see. This is what's happening in their home. And so we can definitely see that this can be a major contributor to why patients may be readmitting back to the hospital and why they're having further problems. So when we look at those contributors to readmissions, a lot of times when working with different hospitals, they already usually have their own care processes. They have their own inpatient care processes. They have they do a lot of their own med rec. They have programs set up. They have pharmacists involved with it. They do a lot of discharge planning, and they could be doing a great job with all the things around that they have that control over. But where there's a potential, not really potential, where there is a gap in care is that post-discharge follow-up. Think about that picture again. That's a definite gap in care. This is a patient that actually had everything right, had very clear discharge instructions, what they needed to do, but when they got home, they got back into a situation that was not conducive for their health. And this was a problem that many hospitals face. No matter everything they can do that's within their control, when that patient goes back to the home, they are not having the success that we want to see patients have. This is something that's really important. This is where the community pharmacist can actually play a role in this giant puzzle. As pharmacists, we have that unique skill set. We have that ability to look at a lot of times at the medications that a patient is using, to really see what's happening with them, and it creates an important gap, an important resolution for this gap as part of this large puzzle across these different teams and the organizations. So one of the things I'm going to start getting into here in just a moment, I want to talk a little bit about one of our programs that we have done. But we'll get to that in a minute. So there's a lot of different areas that a community pharmacy can kind of implement a transitions of care program. So one of the big ones, and I've actually had this come up a lot of in discussions with payers as well, that their big concern is the medication reconciliation. And this really isn't about the med rec that happens necessarily in the hospital, but really about what happens when the patient goes home. What do they actually have in the home? So they can have the perfect discharge list, the medication list, this is what they need to have. But who's making sure that after they leave the hospital, that's what they go home with? So this is an area where, again, for community pharmacists, where if you're given the opportunity to have those discharge orders, to really be able to look at a patient's list, talk with a patient, then you can actually provide a much more streamlined and accurate medication reconciliation. A lot of times the prescription management. So how does a patient get their prescriptions? Is it something they're leaving the hospital with? Do they have to make another stop after they leave the hospital to get their medications? Or oftentimes what we've seen is patients, they say, yes, I have a way to get my medications. I'm going to make sure I get them so they get discharged from the hospital. And what they really mean is, I have a way to get my medications in 2 weeks when my daughter comes back in town and she'll take me to the pharmacy. So that oftentimes can be a major gap that can lead back to a readmission. So if we can help look at that kind of resolution, that's another area, making sure patients, when they get home, they have the right medications on hand. Helping with discharge patient education. Oftentimes, when the discharge process can be very convoluted, a lot of patients will just agree and say, yes, yes, of course, I get it, because all they want to do is go home. That's their goal, is to get out of the hospital and get back to the home. So helping with that discharge education, after they've had a chance to leave, there may be a definite opportunity there to help make sure they have the proper education in a setting that they may be a little bit more receptive to the education that you provide. Helping with some of the discharge handoffs. Instead of doing, make sure you're having some good soft handoffs, actually having that communication with the inpatient care team. It's another area, and helping advocate for patients in that is another area where pharmacists can assist. And then also that post-acute follow-up care. Who are they seeing after they get home? Do they know who they're scheduled with? Is there something that pharmacists can do directly with patients, helping with some of that med rec, doing that education, doing some of those face-to-face visits, maybe telephonic visits, maybe doing in-home visits? So there's some ways that pharmacists can continue to provide care for that patient to make sure that when they go home out of the hospital, to help reduce those readmissions and make sure that the patient is safe with their medications. A few considerations I want to get to for a successful implementation. There's a few things to always make sure you kind of consider as you're looking at your own program is how are we going to design it? What should it look like? One of the things that's going to be very, very important is to have a hospital champion. It's great to have your own program and start designing it, but it's really hard to just take it to a hospital, to one of their administrators, pharmacy director, whoever, and if you don't have somebody in the hospital that says, I need to have this, I want this, it's really hard to really make a strong case to get implementation. There's a few different ways you can find a hospital champion. Sometimes it is working with the pharmacy department. If you meet with their pharmacy director and show the program. But other areas that where we've actually had success is actually working with some of the specific divisions and sections within hospitals. So looking at like cardiology for CHF patients, as you'll learn in a moment, has been where we actually had a lot of success finding a hospital champion, get one of their physicians on board, but then help get the administrative director on board and really kind of getting people who are getting the physicians involved was a really strong way of getting that hospital champion. You also need to make sure you're looking at your geographical area. If you're in an urban area, it's probably going to be a little bit different program than if you're in a very rural area. You need to decide how are patients going to get to you, or how are you going to be able to get to patients? And that's something that's going to take a lot of consideration. Is it a hospital, a level one trauma center serving patients all over the state, or is it just a local hospital, a small bed, and just fairly local that way? So definite considerations you need to kind of work out. You need to figure out how communications are going to happen. And this is, I mentioned this a couple times, this is probably one of the most important things to really figure out. If everybody's working on their own communication system, their own individual system, it makes it a lot harder to see success. One of the things that you'll hear me mention a couple times is if you can get on if you're working with a hospital and getting on their EMR, doing things directly within their workflow, things that they're used to seeing, and being able to get that within your own workflow, that's going to be paramount for really having successful implementation of any program. You're going to need to discuss what are the payment models, and we'll actually talk about these a little bit more later, but really trying to figure out what is the payment model going to look like, and who are you going to partner with as far as those payment models, because there may be multiple people involved in this process. So it may not just be your pharmacy and a hospital, but maybe you're also working with insurance payers. Maybe you're working with other social work groups who can help identify and follow up with patients. So you need to kind of think about what some of those payment models will look like. And of course, you're going to need to make sure you measure metrics. You're going to need to have data. If you're not getting the right data, if you're not able to show the value of the program, it's something that it's going to, because it's, even when you have a successful program, you have to show that continued success, or administration's finances are going to look and say, do we really need to be paying for this? So you need to make sure you have metrics. And we'll actually also go over some of the metrics that we've done and that ones that definitely should be considered for any program that you're looking at. So quick kind of just assessment question, which of the following are methods a community pharmacy can have a role in transitions of care? Be involved with bedside delivery of medications, in-home medication reconciliation, provide discharge instructions to patient, all of the above or only A and B? You said, I did not know the answer. Okay, well, the answer is E. So we can do bedside delivery, we can do the in-home med rec. We don't provide the discharge instructions directly to the patient, but we can be involved in the education. The discharge instructions still would come from the hospital, but we can help assist that education and the patient understanding of what needs to happen next. So what I'm going to do now is I want to discuss the program that we've actually worked on. It's called the Heart to Heart program. This started really last fall is when it really kind of ramped up and started going. We worked with the Virginia Mason Heart Institute. It's really looking at CHF patients, really focused on 30-day all-cause readmissions. So the reason we started with CHF, well, one, it's one of those CMS targets with the HRRP program, but also it's really the number one cause for readmissions, which is probably one of the reasons that CMS targets it. And these are kind of those top three conditions for 3-day readmissions. Even when heart failure is not the number one, the primary diagnosis for the readmission, is usually still highly involved with other readmissions, even related with pneumonia and COPD, which are also specific CMS targets for readmission. And this is something that's not just like a single hospital problem. This slide is always interesting because as we look across hospitals, looking at the hospitals that are doing the best with heart failure versus the ones that are having the most struggles with heart failure readmissions, the top hospitals really are right around 22% readmission rate. So if we think like our Mayo Clinics, our Johns Hopkins, they are still struggling with heart failure compared to maybe those hospitals that maybe are in smaller budgets, rural areas, struggle more with it. They're up around 27% readmission rate. So really about 1 in 4 patients that discharge from the hospital with CHF are going to end up back in the hospital. So there's definitely a clear need there. Now, one of the things when we started working with Virginia Mason on this project is this is something that they actually created is they were trying to identify what are the reasons that they were having struggling with not adherence with discharge regimens and why were people kind of coming back to the hospital. 3 out of 4 of the main things they identified all related to medications. So patients uneducated regarding meds, they can't afford the meds, they're uncomfortable with side effects, and then of course motivation and patients who are just not engaged in their own care. So with this program, we created it. This was a grant-funded program, so we did have grants from the Cardinal Health Foundation, the St. Jude Medical Foundation, and the Community Pharmacy Foundation. And this program, while it's grant-funded, I'll tell you a little bit more about what kind of the next steps are in just a little bit. Part of the purpose was to figure out how could this be sustained? Would it work to have a pharmacist following up with patients in their CHF program? And can we make a good impact on those readmissions? So this is what our model looked like. So Virginia Mason had their kind of their typical workflow of things that they did with heart failure patients. And so they would continue those aspects. The patients who were identified and enrolled into our program were those that were they had to be hospitalized with primary heart failure, had to have greater than 5 chronic medical conditions, evidence of instability over the last 6 months, which is an interesting criteria because they were in the hospital, which is pretty much evidence of instability, and they had to be a resident of kind of the Puget Sound region. So they needed to be close enough for us to actually be able to reach to them. Our intervention is that we would actually provide 3 home visits and 3 phone consults over a 3-month time period. In that initial 30-day readmission window, usually they would only get 1 home visit and 1 phone call, but then we would continue to see them over that 3-month time period because we were also looking at some of the 90-day readmissions. Even though the CMS and the targeted readmissions were focused on 30-day, for our particular pilot, we wanted to see what happens over the course of 90 days and see if there were further interventions and if some of the interventions we made, if they actually sustained. And this was all on top of Virginia Mason doing their usual care. So they usually had nurses involved calling patients within 2 days of discharge and then trying to get patients into the clinic within 7 to 14 days after discharge. So one of the questions, and this is something that you're very likely to encounter is that people will ask why a pharmacist home visit model. There's home health nurses, there's other social workers, why send a pharmacist to the home? And this was something that a question that Virginia Mason had, but they also answered it themselves, which actually was very helpful for us in some of that trying to create that argument and that discussion of why we should be involved. One thing they actually did find is there was a webinar that they had seen out of Pennsylvania, and I apologize, I don't have a reference for it. But they had actually looked at this at a home visit model for post-discharge patients. And what they found is that when home health nurses went into the home, readmission rates actually went up, whereas if a pharmacist or a PA went into the home, readmission rates went down. So that was kind of one of the things that sold them initially. And then also just looking at types of problems with these patients, it just makes a lot of sense for why a pharmacist. These are very high-risk, complex medical management. Most of the patients are averaging over 14 medications, so there's a lot of potential for drug interactions, misuse, and managing that can be very, very complicated for the patients. Pharmacists have the ability to identify a lot of these medication interactions, and it's within our scope to be able to, in some states and under some circumstances, adjust medications, but mostly to be able to provide appropriate recommendations directly back to the care team to really be able to help make proper interventions on those patients. We actually found that this was a decrease on burden on physicians because instead of them waiting to see the patients and trying to do all the assessment, a lot of that assessment work was already done for them, so they were able to respond faster to some of the other care needs that patients may have. This is kind of the general flow for how our program worked. Being engaged with Virginia Mason was very important. We were on their EMR, not just read access, but write access. And this is one of the things that was very important for our program because they were able to refer patients directly within their system to us. And then we were able to follow up with patients, make calls with them. And then after we would see the patient, we were able to write our notes and make our recommendations directly within the EMR. And they used Cerner. And we were able to send those, any recommendations, questions, concerns directly to the doctor right in their workflow so that they could respond very, very quickly. And so that really helped. And then we were able to do other follow-ups and be able to see everything that's going on with the patient in that EMR. So here's some of the initial demographics. This is we actually have more patients now than here, but this is the data that we have collected that I had available to report. So based on the first kind of initial 30 patients, most of the patients had about 14 to 15 medications, so very difficult patients. There were a lot of high-risk medications in use, and a very diverse profile of medical conditions, diabetes, COPD, depression, so definitely a very complex patient panel. These were some of the problems that we are often identifying. We identified over 274 different medication-related problems. Most of these really were related to safety with the patients, but we also, of course, looked at things regarding efficacy. Did doses need to be titrated or tapered off? And then also while we were seeing a lot of these patients, we were able to do some other potential prevention harm reduction. Do they need updates on their vaccine? Are they eligible for Zostavax, Pneumovax, whatever it may be? And then also looking at, are they having other cost issues? Are they having access, transportation issues, those types of things? Of our interventions, we've performed over 356 total interventions. I'm sorry, it looks like this slide here got a little bit goofy. I apologize for that. But a good amount of our interventions were related to patient education to try and make sure patients understood what they were doing, what they should be doing in the home. Another 25% related to medication modification, and then, of course, some of the additional services. Provider response from this program, and this is something talking with a lot of the nurses and with VM, we had a 70% acceptance rate of our interventions, which is fantastic. So providers were very engaged and did like our recommendations. We were able to get those actually implemented. One of the cardiologists, you know, just loves this program, so that they've been very, very supportive of it. And we've seen a good resolution of a lot of our of these interventions that that we're making. From the patient standpoint, this is another important metric to have. Actually, this is something I found that a lot of insurance payers want to see, because this is one of the things that they're very concerned with as well. But the patient satisfaction was great. And on just a 5-point Likert scale, evaluating patients, like what did they think about this type of service before we ever showed up, and then kind of after our last visit, most patients were about a 3, so they were kind of more of a, they don't think it was going to really help, but they don't think it would hurt, so kind of whatever. But then by the time they were done, they definitely saw a lot of value. We definitely see an increase in that satisfaction. Patients felt it was very valuable to have pharmacists coming to them in their home after discharge. But all of this is great. These are all very cool metrics, but in the end, the biggest thing we really need to focus on are those big outcomes, that value base. So what happened with readmissions, because that's what's going to be important to the hospital, to payers, for patients, everyone. So in our program, Virginia Mason was at about a 22% when they started, and we've with the patients that we've seen, it's down to 6.6%. I do know that we've increased more, we've had more patients come in, and none of them have gone back to the hospital, so that number is even a little bit lower now. But we've had very good success with these with this program, getting these readmissions down. And the fun thing is, none of these have been these readmissions have been related to CHF. They've all been all cause, because that is the metric that they look at for those readmissions. So it's been very satisfying to see that these interventions that we're making, this work we're doing, has had a positive impact on patients and readmissions. So some of the next steps for this program, we actually were just awarded another grant to expand this program. This particular model was really looking at that hospital to home addressing patients there. This grant expansion is really looking at patients going from hospital to a SNF, then to the home. So we're actually working on out some of the logistics of what that program will look like, and that's actually going to start in 2017. So we have a little bit of time before that happens, but that's one of the next phases. And this program in its current way is also going to continue. So we'll continue to see get referrals on CHF patients from hospital to home. We're also now working with their pulmonology department and potentially their internal medicine department to start focusing this also on COPD patients. We'll get our target was to get up to 50 patients. We're getting pretty close to that. I think we just hit about 40, 45, something like that. And then looking at how we can continue, though always the big questions are, how can we scale this to get more patients enrolled, to be able to do this in a larger larger geographic areas and get more patients? How is this going to be sustainable, and what's going to be kind of the return on investment for the hospital, the pharmacy, and payers, and everyone that that is involved with this? So now another quick assessment question. Which of the following are outside the control of a community pharmacy for implementation of a transition of care program? Contacting patient prior to discharge from hospital, obtaining access to hospital EMR, identifying patients to refer into the transition of care program, all of the above, or only B, only obtaining access to the hospital EMR. Let's see if it highlights this time. It does not. No worries. So the answer is E, obtaining access to the hospital EMR. It's definitely within the community pharmacy. We can contact patients prior to discharge from hospital and identify patients, but there will need to be a lot of work with the hospital to get the EMR. And one thing I would mention about our particular program is that that was kind of one of the initial barriers that we had to work through. As soon as we've gotten that, it's actually been very easy to continue to use that and to use that system, and they've been very supportive of it. Okay. So kind of really the next thing is that, how is this going to be sustainable, and what are the things that need to be considered in order to sustain any type of program? So there's a few different ways and a few different models that this can be done. One of these is really first kind of looking at a shared savings model. So right now, so if a hospital is being charged for those readmissions through that HRP scoring, if you can reduce their penalty and they don't have to be paying out as much and not having it impacting their DRG payments that they're getting from Medicare, that's something that could definitely be worth it for many hospitals, especially if it's someone that's if they have a large penalty. You know, they're looking at upwards of $1 million of a penalty. They may be very interested, and if they can get that down, and if your program is able to help bring that down, that having a shared savings model, the nice thing about that too is it does provide some incentive for the pharmacy, and it's kind of a shared risk for both the hospital and the community pharmacy, so that if it doesn't work out, the hospital doesn't feel like they are spending a lot of money on something that doesn't work. Of course, that also puts a lot of risk on the pharmacy as well, because you have to make sure you get the results and actually bring those savings down to be able to actually get a proper return on investment for that. Another system is looking at a per member per month payment system. So if you're just looking at patients across the board, every time they have certain patients, maybe there's just a kind of a flat rate for that and how many patients that are potentially eligible. This is actually something that I've found that insurance companies and payers is a model that they're more familiar with and something that they tend to kind of gravitate towards. So they can say, here's our high risk population. We'll pay you X amount of dollars for to take care of this patient. So if they go into the hospital, you need to be there to help them with readmissions, which can be a good way, because if a patient requires very little effort and very little intervention, it could, and you have a decent rate, it is a way to actually have a good continual return on investment. But you also have to be careful with those populations, because if you get a very high intensity population that requires a lot of effort to keep them from readmitting, that whatever that rate is may not be enough to actually cover the cost of being able to do that. And so another more considerations with that. A flat fee per patient. So each time you see a patient, the way our model is set up right now from our program, it actually is on this flat fee per patient. Is that they just say, when there's a patient, they say, this is the rate we're going to pay you to take care of this patient. And so we get paid, whether the patient readmits or not, we just get paid for that patient to provide the service. And this is a good way, the benefit of this model is that you know what you're going to get. So when you get a patient referral, you know exactly what you're going to get. So you can actually run your numbers to actually figure out your ROI and figure out, is this something that we're going to be able to do and be able to change your workflow and processes accordingly. It's not always something that maybe the hospitals like, just simply because if you're not getting good results, they may want to cancel any contract with that. Well, you can also look at medication dispensing. If you're doing a bedside delivery, or if you're doing any kind of adherence packaging or anything, it may be a way of bringing in more volume and more patient fills, and so margins on the medications may be there as part of your program as well. But again, something you need to look at, and if you're looking at the plans, what types of margins you're getting, to make sure that if you are increasing that volume, because if you are increasing the volume, that could be good, but only if it's continuing refill business, because there can be a lot more work in that initial outlay of getting a patient, entering in new patients, setting them up, getting all their insurance, and taking care of a lot of that. If they're not going to continue filling with your pharmacy, it could be not as good an ROI on that. And then there's also transitional care management codes that are out there, and I'll actually show those in just a minute and explain them. One thing I did want to share is there's also one of the things you need to consider is if you are looking at hospitals in your area, you really need to find out what is their penalty. Is it a hospital that is it one of the ones that is being penalized, or are they being penalized at a rate that actually can make that argument to look at trying to reduce those readmissions. Decided to share this website. It's called www.checkmypenalty.com. It has just a really quick, easy sign up that you can do, and then you can actually search different hospitals across the country, and so you can actually see kind of what on those CMS targeted conditions, what are their current rates, and are they in kind of that penalty range, and kind of what is their current penalty? So you can just kind of take a look at this one that I have on the screen here. You see at this particular hospital was a 0.04%. So the penalty may seem very low. So one of the things you'd have to consider is, well, what does that penalty mean? Is this a large hospital? Is this like a 1,000-bed hospital? So maybe 0.04 may not seem like much, but it actually is pretty significant. Or is this maybe a 30-bed hospital, in which case they have very, very, it may have a low impact on maybe their overall operations. And so definitely something to check out. And so if you're looking at that plan, looking at those hospitals that you want to partner with, it's good to know where their weak areas are. Another thing this is good for is you may be thinking, oh, I'm going to do a CHF program. And then you go and you look at the hospital CHF rate, and they're not getting any penalty on it. So maybe a harder sell. And so you need to figure out, well, how do I want to handle that type of program? Do I need to change it, find a different partner? So it's a way to some considerations in designing your program. The TCM codes, those transitional care codes, these are special codes that were developed specific for basically transitions of care, and a way of trying to incentivize hospitals, clinicians. Basically what it does is the requirements are that there has to be communication with the patient or caregiver within 2 business days after discharge. And that can be done by really just about anybody. So a lot of hospitals use maybe their nurses or to be able to kind of do that call. This is something, if it's a hospital that's not doing it, that may be a way for as a community pharmacist to be able to help take on some of that challenge and be able to start getting more patients identified and supported. There has to be a face-to-face visit within the specified days of discharge, and that does have to be a physician visit. And depending on the level of the code, and so you can see both of them there. If it's just a moderate level, it has to be within 14 days discharge. If it's considered a high-level medical decision complexity, it has to be 7 days of discharge. Now, one of the challenges of this is not something that as a pharmacist that you can bill for directly yourself. But this is something that the hospital or the clinic, depending on who's going to be kind of following up and taking care of that patient, they can be submitting these codes. And this is something that pharmacists can help support with. And again, if you're meeting with that patient, you're able to give a lot of that assessment, a lot of the information before they see the physician. It can decrease that physician burden, maybe, and so they can maybe see those patients faster, less time, so they can kind of, it'll be easier in their workflow and increase the chance that they're going to be able to have successful codes and actually be able to bill on these codes. The other thing about these particular codes is the patient can't go back to the hospital within 30 days. So if the patient does go back, the clinic, the physician, whoever bills it, can't get paid for it. And sometimes the question is, well, what's kind of the reimbursement like on these codes? I've actually included a website here. This is the Medicare fee-for-service website where you can actually go in, and if you enter any CPT code, you can put in any modifiers. Usually, if you keep it as all modifiers and put in your specific region, you can kind of see what are these kind of bill at. So this is another way that you can potentially look at a model and figure out, okay, if I'm helping with these TCM codes, and helping maybe with those 2-day follow-up calls or helping with some of the assessment and doing that, is there a model that you can kind of create from that? And you can get a sense of what each patient is kind of going to get paid on those codes. And that's something you can look up on your own. The other important thing, as we'll talk about again, is that value-based data. As we're keep moving toward that value-based model, you have to make sure you can show that value-based data, because that high-value purchasing is really what hospitals, insurance plans are looking for. So you need to make sure you can show the data that they want to see. So one of the biggest one is you need to be able to show the readmission rates. You need to be able to show that you bring those down, because if there's no readmission rates, it's kind of becomes a question mark. They're not a payer, a hospital may not know if they want to partner with you, but if you can have those readmission rates, it definitely strengthens your case. Patient satisfaction is an important one. Everybody wants their patients happy. If you can show any system-specific metrics, such as the HEDIS measures, star ratings, things like that, and show how you're able to help identify some of those metrics, that's another way that you can actually be showing value for your particular for your service. So, for example, if you're doing immunizations when a patient's coming in, you're maybe doing an MTM follow-up after a discharge, if you can show that you're helping them hit some of their immunization metrics and some of their HEDIS ratings, that's another way that can be enticing for payers or for hospitals and clinics. If you can show another thing that we actually talked about measuring was just general improved visit rates. So if you're able to help keep patients more engaged in the system and actually show up for their visits, so if they're actually showing up for that 7-day follow-up, that 14-day follow-up, that increases the amount of billing that that clinicians can and physicians and hospitals can do. So that's another way. And if you can show that when they enroll in your service, you can improve those visit rates, that's another way to drive revenue back into that clinic, which is another way to strengthen your argument. Medication reconciliation. Again, this is something really important, because this is something that JCO payers, they want hospitals, clinics doing this. They want to see a really good rate. And so if you can show that you're able to help with that medication reconciliation and get it done properly, and that can be of value for whoever you're working with. And then any chance you can show how you're avoiding adverse drug events or errors. This is something that a lot of the the quality improvement organizations are really been tasked to look at as well. So the one in our region is known as Qualys, but they're, so you have to find out for your own region who it is. But this is something they look at, and if you're able to help help them show that you're recognizing adverse drug events and that you're able to avoid them, this is also another way to start showing that value and getting support from other outside organizations. So here's another quick assessment question. So what are the ways a community pharmacy may be reimbursed for a transition of care program? Is it a fee-for-service from the hospital, a pharmacist billing under TCM codes, a shared savings model with hospital for readmission reductions? All of the above are only A and C? The answer is E, only A and C. So again, just as a reminder, the pharmacist, we can't bill the TCM code directly, but we can support and make sure that if those codes aren't being done, we can help make sure that there's support for getting those codes billed, as long as the physician is able to do those face-to-face visits. So really the biggest question that I would like to end with is, who do you need to succeed? Who do you need to partner with? And really identifying who are those potential partners within the hospitals, with payers, and across the community. Because again, this is not really a siloed type of program. The transitions, to really make them work, you have to make sure you have a good partnership with the open communication. And there are lots of people that need to be involved to really help make sure you can make an impact on transitions and on patients. So that's all that I have for now. Love to have any questions.
Bring your attention back again. I mentioned something that I was let's jump right into the discussion. We already have some paid.
Sure, I can handle both these questions and not give anything away. So the average per member per month fee, I've seen these a pretty wide range, could be anywhere from maybe $30 to $70 on these. So they can be very wide, but it really does depend on the patient population. So if you're given a population and you have to see every single patient, and it's a very high risk population that requires a lot of interventions, those fees are going to have to go up to be able to compensate it. One of the real goals with those per member per month fees is that it's kind of almost like works like insurance. Everybody pays in hopes that you never have to use it. So if you can, so you really have to look at that patient population to really figure out, like, what do you think it's going to be? How many of those, so if it's 100 patients, how many of those patients do you expect to see? And then what is the intervention that you're doing? Is it an in-home? Is it just bringing them into the pharmacy? Is it just a telephonic follow-up? So you have to look at kind of that, your workflow as well. But it can, so it can range quite a bit. And really the same type of thing for a flat fee. It depends on, again, the level of intervention. Are you doing a full-on in-home visit and you're going to follow them for 3 months? Are you going to follow them for only like the one-time visit? Are they coming to your pharmacy? Again, is it telephonic? One thing I will say is that our average time for like that, when we do that first patient visit, or travel, documentation, getting there and kind of doing some of the prep, usually it's about 3.5 hours total time per patient. Some are less, some a little bit more. That's kind of about a general ballpark average. Okay, so. Yep, so in that particular case, that's something that we keep track. They know the number of referrals that they send, because they actually have identified the patients and send the referral to us. So they can verify, but we track. So after we've received the referral, because there's still a chance, even after we receive the referral, when we contact the patient may change their mind and then decline the program. So then we would not bill for a patient that declines that we don't do anything with. But then every patient that we see after we've completed, we'll then basically we send an invoice back to the hospital to say, this is the number of patients that we saw this month. And then they just cut a check and send it to us. So the nice thing is there is no other additional kind of insurance billing, coding, anything like that. So it's from that standpoint, it makes it very easy to bill the hospital that way. Okay. So... Yes, absolutely. So one thing I've found is, while it was very important that the pharmacy department knew that this was going on, and I kind of had the opportunity to talk about it, it actually was not the pharmacy department within the hospital that really pushed this forward. It was, with this particular case, it was really looking with cardiology. For this initial program, one thing that was helpful is that they had already identified the need, so they knew that they needed something in this post-acute follow-up, and they weren't sure exactly which way they were going to go. They were going to use PAs, or if they're going to use pharmacists, or how that was going to work. But then, and this, while this could be an entirely different presentation about the importance of relationships, but it was actually one of our relationships with a from a different program, a nurse that had transferred in different departments and that ended up at Virginia Mason and at the cardiology department. She helped facilitate an introduction, said, oh, I know somebody that might be able to help you. And so they was able to facilitate some of that relationship. So instead of us just kind of cold calling and saying, hey, I think you want to talk to us, there was that initial introduction, and then we were able to really kind of get the discussion rolling. So even though you may be working with somebody that's not directly related with transitions of care, one thing I would definitely say is you need to make sure you have very good, strong relationships with other people, especially with people outside of pharmacy, other nurses, physicians, home health, because you never know when that's going to really pay off to help facilitate that introduction to that key person that's really going to resonate to have that discussion. Now, as we're expanding, one thing we were able to do, because we had already been working with cardiologies, was I was able to ask, hey, we're interested in expanding to this other area. Who should I talk to? And they said, oh, well, they're able to give me the name and kind of facilitate that introduction. And now we're in this process, and we're getting through developing with around COPD, basically taking the same model, expanding a little bit, but it's going much, much smoother because we've already kind of worked out a lot of the bugs, but... but yeah, those relationships and facilitating those intros is what's going to be really, really important. I think that's exactly right. You need to make sure you're adaptable, and really if you can find out what are the hospital's needs, because it's good that we have the ability to be adaptable, and it's good to have a plan and an idea of what you can do, but if the hospital doesn't need it, or they don't want it, or they don't understand it, yeah, you're always going to meet that resistance. And so anytime you can, it's really about helping them understand why they would need to have that post-acute care, and what are they maybe even asking, so what do you do with patients post-acute? So not you do you never want to say they're doing a bad job with readmissions. They know where their rates are, and they're doing a lot of work, But the important thing is to understand, well, what are you doing about the post-acute care? When you no longer have kind of that control of the patient, so to speak, then what happens next? Who's seeing them? Do you have somebody out there? Are you working with social work? Are they getting out to the patient? Is the patient engaging in other ways? And so then if you have a way that you yet another kind of touch point where you can engage patients to help activate them, and that you can say, this is how I can continue to support what you guys are doing, I think that's kind of where the discussion needs to go, and just knowing what they already have in place. And then the other thing too is sometimes if a hospital or whoever you're working with just isn't ready, don't be disappointed. It may not be quite time yet. You may need to adapt, but just kind of sometimes you just have to keep trying and modifying, and eventually maybe they will be suddenly see where the value is, because that is something that's happening. Some hospitals are more, I would say, more ahead of the curve than others, especially looking at this kind of value-based system, where it's a lot of hospitals are very resistant to kind of move to that because their typical payments have always been more heads and beds. That's where their payment model is. And so even though a readmission, they want to avoid that, they may still be getting more money, even though they have a penalty, they still get paid more by having a patient in the hospital. And so sometimes that can be an argument that's difficult to work against, but the model itself is changing. And then if the hospital may not be ready today, it doesn't mean they won't be. So, yes. Oh, yes, please do. Okay. Yes. Sure. Quick answer is yes. At the rate that we were charging, it was sustainable. So both VM wants to continue to pay because they see the value, and then also we are able to continue doing it simply because we had it at a rate that was able to provide to cover a lot of the time that was involved with those patients. I do a little bit there, so I'll kind of quickly say that as long as they are credentialed, so if they have a physician MD and they are credentialed with whichever insurance, Medicare, whoever, and that's what they can build, then absolutely they should be able to do those, because they could do that face-to-face follow-up for the TCM reimbursement codes. As far as a collaborative practice agreement, I'm not totally clear. If it's a physician, then they shouldn't need one, but they could help set it up for other pharmacists and be kind of the medical director. And then as far as the physical clinic space, again, because of how the coding works, if they're doing it out of a hospital, that would be a very different type of, that's a different billing because there's also additional facility fees. Whereas if they are in another clinic space, they would need to have, they need to be able to say where they are seeing the patient. But there are multiple codes within medical billing where you actually have to identify where you see the patient, whether it's in the home, in a pharmacy, in a clinic. But so there would need to be some space, or if you're doing it telephonically. But again, telephonically would not be allowed for that 7 to 14 days. That does have to be face to face somewhere. Then what was this last part? And then really that just gets into kind of the contracting. Last question, as far as the ambulatory care clinic, just kind of gets into the contracting and how you want to split it up, and so that's where the kind of that discussion takes place. But potentially, yeah, you could, if you're billing those TCM codes and you're getting, and they're getting reimbursement from that, and you are part of that process, then yes, there could be a way that you are able to share that, but that would just have to be worked out directly with the organization. Thank you.